This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, former CIA official Ray McGovern discusses how U.S. intelligence veterans are debunking current Russia hacking claims.
It's not a hack. It's a leak from an insider. Listen in. This is a huge story.
Attorney Mara Verheiden-Hilliard joins us from Washington, D.C. to discuss what we can expect from the new Trump administration.
She directs a civil rights law firm, which has won a number of important cases in defense of our civil liberties. Mara Verheiden-Hilliard is truly a lawyer you'll like.
As the Obama administration draws to a close, we discuss some of the political prisoners that Obama can pardon.
He can do the right thing, and you can help him get there.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The major media has been filled daily with stories about how Russia and its chief of state, Vladimir Putin, sought to and did influence the American election in favor of Donald Trump. It is alleged by the CIA and other American intelligence agencies that the Russians hacked into the computer systems of the Democratic National Committee and of Hillary Rodham Clinton. This conclusion, it is reported, is based on, quote, overwhelming circumstantial evidence. American public opinion is being shaped to support aggression against Russia. Despite a promise made to Russia that they would not do it, the promise was broken, and NATO, an American-controlled military alliance, now has troops and weapons on the Russian border, where military exercises have been carried out. Tensions have been ratcheted up to an extreme level, not known since the height of the Cold War. We speak today with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. McGovern was the person who briefed President George Bush daily. He broke with the government under George W. Bush over the cooked intelligence used to rationalize America's illegal war of aggression against Iraq and helped form the organization Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Last week, his group issued a memorandum to President Obama, which demonstrated that the Russians did not hack into the computers of the Democratic Party or Hillary Clinton, and did not, therefore, influence the American election. They asserted that the information that came out about the corruption of Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party was leaked by an insider, not hacked.
Ray McGovern, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Ray, according to all the major news media, and I'm going to quote here, overwhelming circumstantial evidence leads the CIA to believe that Putin deployed computer hackers with the goal of tipping the election to Donald Trump. Is this statement evidence-free?
Well, yes, it is. Let me put it in context here. Bill Colby, former director of Central Intelligence, for whom I work personally, we work together, he's quoted as having said, quote, the CIA owns everyone of any significance in the major media, end quote. Now, there's some dispute as to whether he actually said that, and I wasn't there when he said it, but the Church Committee findings at about that same time indicated that that was, if not absolutely, very probably true. The other thing I'll cite is Bill Casey, no devotee of the truth, the covert action expert that ran the CIA while I was there. And he said, and this was at a cabinet meeting right when he took power, quote, we'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false, end quote.
Right. Propaganda on all the media is that the Russians hacked into the computer system of Clinton and of the Democratic National Committee. But you don't believe that, do you? You think that it was a leak by an insider. Why do you believe that?
Yeah, it's not a belief. You know, there are two ways to approach this. One is the logic of the situation. The other is the forensics. Now, in our Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, we are privileged to have very, very senior officials from the National Security Agency, now retired, of course, But two who signed this memo, Bill Binney and Kurt Wiebe, have over 75, I say again, 75 years of professional experience at a very senior level. They've looked at all this and have said, if it were a hack, NSA would definitely know about it. All evidence points to the fact that it's not a hack, that it's a leak. Now, the difference, maybe your listeners need to know the difference. Let me just define very briefly. A leak, that's when somebody takes data out of an organization, like with a thumb drive or something, and gives it to some other person or organization. Now, Snowden and Chelsea Manning did leaks. That's how Julian Assange and WikiLeaks got this information. Now, a hack. A hack is when someone in a remote location electronically penetrates operating systems or firewalls or other cyber protection systems and then extracts data. Now, what is the big distinction? Because NSA has the capability, a proven capability, to identify all. It boggles the mind, but it's true. All such hacking. Why? Because the systems that we pay $10 billion a year for are fully capable of tracking each and every email, designating its origin and its destination. So suffice it to say that from a technical point of view, and you know, don't believe McGovern on this. Believe Bill Binney, who was the technical director of NSA when he retired 10 years ago. From a technical point of view, it cannot be Russian hacking, because then our administration and our New York Times and others would be able to say, well, on such and such a date, we have this hacked message, which indicates that Putin called up so-and-so and said, well, you know, let's do this to make sure Hillary doesn't win. The whole thing is a canard. Last thing I'll say, to put it into some perspective, all this happened when Julian Assange, having collected an immense amount of email traffic from Hillary Clinton's and from the Democratic National Committee websites or their emails, he sorted them out, put them in searchable order, and released them 2 days, I repeat, 2 days before the Democratic National Convention. Now, what did they indicate? What was the content? This is important, okay? The content was that Hillary Clinton and the DNC stole the nomination from Bernie Sanders. Pure and simple. Now, what did Hillary do wrong? What are we going to do about this? I know, we'll blame it on the Russians. Well, yeah, but it wasn't the Russians, it was Julian Assange. Well, that's okay. We'll say Julian Assange is blaming the Russians. Okay, well, what would be the rationale? Oh, the rationale? The Russians certainly want Donald Trump to win. Now, give me a break. I know a little bit about how Russian leaders look at U.S. presidents. The last thing Vladimir Putin would want is a president who brags about being unpredictable and who takes has an immense reaction to every slight he receives, whether it's real or imagined. I can't believe that Vladimir Putin had a distinct preference to who would win this election. It was Julian Assange in receipt of a leak. Who did the leak? Well, it has to be somebody within the NSA, or the FBI, or the Democratic National Committee, who got sickened by watching Bernie Sanders cheated out of the nomination.
Yeah, it's even more concrete than that, isn't it, Ray? Craig Murray, the former British ambassador who works sometimes with Assange, has said that he actually met the leaker. And you know Murray. Talk about that, please.
Yeah. Well, both of them are good friends of mine, Julian and Craig. Now, Craig's word is golden. He lost his job as UK ambassador to Uzbekistan because he couldn't stomach getting information from torture, which he observed in person, okay? So he's golden. He's also a recipient, as Julian is, of the Sam Adams Award for Integrity. So what's he saying? And this is the other track. I started with the technical. This is a little squishier, but it's just as real because I know Craig Murray and his reputation for integrity. He says, Hey, guys, listen to me. I know the leaker. I met with the leaker. So please, believe me, it's a leak. And I also know Julian Assange. Now, you can believe him or not believe him, but you know what's really interesting? That got into the UK Guardian, okay, the newspaper. But you know what? I talked to Craig 2 days ago. I said, Craig, did the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, anybody get in touch with you, follow up? He says, are you kidding, Ray? No. I said, well, how do you figure that? He says, come on, Ray, are you kidding? They don't want to know the truth. So that's the other main reason why I'm convinced, and my NSA colleagues are convinced from a technical point of view, this was a leak. It was leaked by somebody inside, that's the definition of a leak, okay, who extracted this information manually, with thumb drive or whatever, and gave it to Julian Assange, who didn't change a word. That's the good thing about WikiLeaks, okay? They don't even take off the metadata, or somebody criticize them for this, but not even the Social Security numbers. Or, you know, they keep it pristine, pure, so that it is beyond reproach, and so that it can be used to get people out of jail or prevent them from getting into jail. So the situation is very clear. The media has gone amok. And people, even people like, well, conservative folks are saying, well, what is this? The FBI doesn't agree with it, obviously. What is CIA doing? And that is the real question.
Ray, why do you think the media is so gung-ho about the hacking idea when there is no basis, in fact, for it?
Yeah, there are basically two reasons. One is that the Democrats and the major media, the ones described by Colby and Casey as being very gullible, haven't been able to wrap their minds around the fact that Hillary lost. But the second and more compelling reason is that if you look at the six major firms, major mega corporations that own the mainstream media, so to speak, their major business areas are in making and selling and giving sophisticated weaponry. Now, why do I say that? Well, because as we all know, peace is very bad for that kind of business. War? Huh? Tension? Oh, man. Look at what's happened since 9/11. So, twin reasons here. The most operative one is the same old one. These people profiteer on war and tension. They like to stoke up tensions with Russia, and they're deadly afraid. I mean, what happens if Trump goes forward with his promise to talk to the Russians, to work things out with the Russians? Easily done with Ukraine, the Baltics. What is the Russian threat? Well, in my view, the Russian threat to these countries is nil. But the Russian threat to the neocons is that they will make a deal with Trump, very easily done, as I said before, and have a detente, a real detente in Europe and the Middle East. And that's what they're afraid of. Trump has made it clear he'd like to do that. There's no reason why it cannot be done except for the opposition of people who profiteer on this kind of tension.
Ray, are you concerned that all of this media coverage ratchets up tensions with Russia in the direction of conflict?
My immediate concern is that it seems to be directed at trying to get as many members of the Electoral College to change their minds. That's very serious. That's in the nature of what I call a preemptive coup. I mean, it can't be described as a coup because Trump isn't president yet, but if you can get enough people to change their minds in the Electoral College, well, you know, we have a real, real crisis in this country. So that's what I see as the immediate thing. Now, the business about stoking up with tensions with Russia, there is a dynamic there, which has been in effect ever since, ever since we sponsored the coup in Kiev, and that's never in the major media, is it? For the major media, modern Central European history begins on the 23rd of February 2014, and no one mentions what happened the day before. The U.S. orchestrated coup in Kiev on Russia's doorstep, which George Friedman of Stratfor called, quote, the most blatant coup in history, period, end quote.
bears repeating that it was Hillary Clinton and her underling Victoria Nuland who engineered that. Nuland bragged about having spent $5 billion to accomplish that. You now have in the Ukraine fascists in the government for the first time since World War II. That's the kind of thing we would have got with Clinton as the president.
Yeah, they're friendly fascists. They're in our camp. They don't like Russia either. I'm being facetious, but you're right, Michael.
With respect to understanding the relationship between the United States and Russia, that was an area of your expertise, and I would like to ask you about that.
My advanced degrees are in Russian history, and I used to teach Russian, and I ran the Soviet foreign policy branch in the CIA analysis department for years. So I briefed presidents on Russian relations and what the Russians were doing. During Reagan's administration, it was one-on-one. So, you know, after I retired, I thought I could, you know, go peacefully into the night. But when I saw my friends, my former colleagues, deliberately distorting information to justify a war that was completely unnecessary, the one on Iraq, well, not only I, but others who feel the way I do about integrity and intelligence came out of the woodwork, and we've been publishing now ever since Colin Powell's speech, which we pointed out was specious, 45 memoranda now. Veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, we're proud of what we did. Our latest one is the one that you're quoting from, which says that the claims of Russian hacking are baseless, and we stand by that judgment.
Ray, I'm curious, what do you think of Donald Trump's comment that he does not need to receive the presidential intelligence briefing every day?
Well, you know, my first reaction was, whoa, how can anybody say that? You know, having labored in that vineyard under not only Reagan, but under Nixon and Ford. I mean, it's a really important document. But look how the CIA has changed. Look at guys running the CIA who hacked into congressional computers, who thought that kidnapping was a great idea to have people tortured in Central Europe. John Brennan is a menace. And so if I were Donald Trump, I would probably have a reaction somewhat similar. I'd say, well, look, Mike Pence is going to get the stuff. Maybe he can sift out the real stuff from the other stuff. And, you know, do I want to hear from the CIA what they're prevaricating about the Russians hacking into our thing? I don't know. I think I'd like to prefer to rely on my own experts and let Mike Pence tell me what the CIA is saying. That's really sorrowful, and it's sorrowful for this reason. There used to be two CIAs, one devoted and committing to telling the truth without fear or favor. We had career protection for doing that. And the other CIA, the operational side, trafficking in lies and deception all the time. Now it's one. Brennan has made it just one CIA. And you imagine what kind of reception an analyst would get. So now look at all the evidence. And I don't see any persuasive evidence that Russians hacked into. Oh, you know, would he get promoted? No, I don't think so. It's that bad.
One last question, Ray McGovern, because we're running out of our allotted time. But what do you think people like me and you and Heidi, what should people be doing about this stuff now?
Well, Michael and Heidi, it's very challenging environment. Stephen Cohen was on Amy Goodman, and he had all he could do to fend off you know, a wonderful person who's terribly naive, the head of the Human Rights Watch, who bought the story about the sarin attacks being part of Assad's offensive, and who is now defending what's going on in Syria from a administration point of view. So all I'm saying is this. Our memorandum has not seen the light of day in this country other than on websites. One would think that the former director of NSA had enough gravitas and panache that somebody would take cognizance of that. Similarly with Craig Murray, ambassador to Uzbekistan for the UK, he knows what he's talking about. So there's got to be a way. There's got to be a way to force this into major media. And the people who used to be able to listen to these things, you know, the Keith Olbermans of this world, they've turned into the worst centers of these flames against Russia. So it's a task that we have to do. And in my view, the premium is on the next 5 days before these electors convene in their state capitals to elect Trump or to fool around in an unprecedented way with our electoral process.
You know, I think everybody should read that memo. How do people get a hold of it?
Well, it's on my website, raymcgovern.com. It's on consortiumnews.com. It's on antiwar.com. It's on all the websites, you know, that we have the choir reading, the usual suspects. What we need to do is to get it out in print, and that's a monumental task because the Times, obviously, the Post and the Wall Street Journal have a vested interest in not telling the truth on this one.
Ray McGovern, as always, it is a pleasure and an honor to speak with you. We look forward to staying in touch over the next few months as things develop further.
And we'll see you at the demonstration in Washington.
Yeah, well, if I disappear from sight, would you look into it?
We will, Ray.
Thanks.
Thanks,
Ray.
You take it easy.
Be safe.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Donald Trump has been critical of the U.S. intelligence community, both as a presidential candidate and as president-elect. He recently said he does not need to receive the presidential intelligence briefing every day, suggesting that such briefings are repetitive and that he is content to rely on those around him on matters of intelligence and national security. Trump's infrequent briefings to date are a departure from every modern president except Richard Nixon, who was so skeptical of intelligence agencies that he refused to accept briefings offered by President Johnson, even returning unopened envelopes containing classified material to the CIA. In Washington, D.C., the public interest organization, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, has a new message on its website. It reads in part, "At the PCJF, we stand with all those who are taking those steps forward, steps together, to face down what is coming, to protect those who are most vulnerable, and to make it clear that the people themselves are the force to be reckoned with." The PCJF has litigated First Amendment and other cases of constitutional import that have helped preserve and even expand the protections afforded individuals in different jurisdictions. Joining us today to talk about the Trump administration and some of the expected key intelligence positions is attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Mara, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
We haven't talked to you since the presidential election, and we wanted to know, were you surprised at the outcome, and what were your earliest concerns about the nation's new commander-in-chief?
I think this outcome actually is a natural consequence of the direction the Democratic Party has taken, specifically under the leadership of both Clintons. You can see from when the Clintons first took office that they went in the direction of moving away from addressing the needs of the people of the United States and instead focusing on really trying to embrace what used to be a Republican agenda, you know, from ending welfare, from curtailing habeas corpus. And these were all positions that traditionally would not have been under the purview of the Democratic Party. And so when Hillary Clinton began running for office and was running really in a rightward bent, she was only pulled back to a progressive agenda to the extent she was at all because of the role of Bernie Sanders and really his supporters in the race. So in the end, when Bernie Sanders was vanquished by the time of the opening of the convention, and the rest of the convention just frankly began to look like an old Republican Party convention, you have millions of people in the United States, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people, who are desperately in need of a change in their daily lives and their living conditions and their access to jobs, to decent education, to health care without soaring premiums. And the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton weren't responding to any of that. So while Donald Trump was going around saying, we need jobs, we need to address these problems that working people are facing, Hillary Clinton was saying, we need to make sure that Russia doesn't take over America. And so, you know, guess what? The people of Wisconsin actually cared more about jobs. That's really the direction that was happening during this campaign. So you could see that it was possible that someone as absolutely unstable and unqualified as Donald Trump could become president when that's the landscape.
I think that Hillary Clinton was such a unpopular candidate that people didn't come out to vote for her. Obama got 5 million more votes than she did in 2012 and 9 million more 4 years before that. And one interesting statistic I read was that in Michigan, which was a key state, 90,000 people voted for everything but did not vote for president. They voted for the ballot initiatives, the down ticket stuff, but they just left the ballot blank on the presidential vote. So I think that the Democrats led with their chin on this one with Clinton, and Trump was able to make hay out of it.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there were so many people who could not stand either candidate, and Hillary Clinton kept campaigning saying things like, literally saying, I am the only thing that stands between you and the apocalypse, at a point in time where it was clear that she was starting to really lose ground in the Rust Belt. She didn't come in and support labor. She didn't come in and support working people's needs. She just kept coming back to, you have to vote for me because Trump is so awful. And that simply wasn't enough to carry the day. No longer can you run for political office in the United States when you have people that are really suffering so much and not seek to address their needs. And it's not that we think that Donald Trump is going to do anything for working people in the United States. To the contrary. But he's a demagogue, and he was willing to say anything to get elected.
Yeah, they thought he would. And he represented to them change, which was what people wanted most. And
right.
they didn't, I think, really understand what this guy is all about. But we're going to talk about that.
Mara, given the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund's work defending constitutional rights, and you have a challenge to some of the protesters' access to the inauguration, which we want to talk about in a few minutes, what do you see from Trump's picks for his cabinet and key positions in intelligence as really some of our greatest threats to civil liberties going forward?
Well, he is putting together a government and a cabinet that is basically creating a country run by generals and oligarchs. And across the board, virtually every pick that he has is, aside from issues of qualified and more specifically unqualified, these are people with extremist, dangerous positions. And you have someone like Michael Flynn, as National Security Advisor, General Michael Flynn, who was fired from his position at the DIA based on the fact that many people inside suggested that he was, frankly, unstable, that he's a lunatic. I mean, he's like the Dr. Strangelove of the cabinet at this point. And And other associates actually said that they just didn't even think that he was that bright.
Yeah, he was infamous for issuing what his own subordinates called Flynn facts, which were fact-free opinions. And the people that worked for him actually made fun of him.
No, he's an open Islamophobe. He's openly attacked Muslims in America. He has no hesitation to suggest that Muslims in America, in and of themselves, as people who, you know, of a particular faith, are basically a national security threat. And he poses a danger to the United States, to the people of the United States.
Meyer, talk to us about who's going to become the new Attorney General, Jeff Sessions.
Well, Jeff Sessions, who's from Alabama as a senator, was previously rejected when he was nominated as a federal judge because of racist comments that he'd made. I mean, one would have thought that those rejections would be sufficient that the man could not be Attorney General now. But he's there he is. So you have someone who's going to be running the Justice Department that has made statements, or has others have said he made statements that were openly racist statements, that had made comments about supporting the KKK, which of course he said were a joke. I just don't know people that feel that you can jokingly say that you support the KKK. And he's someone that's completely opposed to immigration reform. He, too, poses a danger for the people of the United States. And this is what so many people are seeing, what immigrants are seeing, what vulnerable communities are seeing, that you have this cabinet, you have this government taking shape that is really putting them under threat. I mean, people are very frightened around the country as to what will happen next. Will there be mass deportations of millions of people? And, you know, we've heard that people are starting to form self-defense committees, which is understandable around the country.
Mara, talk a bit, if you will, about the Director of National Intelligence and how important that position is. It's rumored, for example, that Admiral Mike Rogers, who's currently the director of the NSA, is being considered for that, among a couple of other people. Do you see that as a position that should be held by a military person or a civilian?
Well, this again goes to this issue of how many generals he's appointing. I mean, historically in the United States, the idea is that there is civilian control over the military. And this is getting turned on its head with so many generals being appointed to take over what are civilian positions and what should be civilian positions. And I think it shows something, too, about Donald Trump and his immediate teen idol worship of men in uniform and his desire that if someone's a general, well, then they must be wonderful and let me just appoint them. Here you have Mike Rogers. I mean, Mike Rogers in 2014 said that he thought that Edward Snowden was a traitor and, quote, I would charge him with murder. And that's the man now that is likely to become Director of National Intelligence, unless we get Carly Fiorina, which is the other person that was being circulated this past week. I don't even know what the basis is that anyone thinks that she would have to hold that position.
What about the other general, James Mattis, known as Mad Dog Mattis, for his massacre of civilians in Fallujah? What position is he going to hold?
Well, Mad Dog Mattis, who is going to be Secretary of Defense, interestingly enough, there have been some news reports that suggest he might have even been recommended by Obama. But here you have General Mattis, who has made comments like it's fun to shoot some people, which is really just a personification of the endless violence and endless warfare of the United States over the last, well, more than a decade. Trump made that comment, too, about how General Mattis may have changed his mind on, or did change his mind on, waterboarding, which, again, says a lot about the competency of the President of the United States. I mean, waterboarding is torture. Torture is illegal. Donald Trump was all for talking up how wonderful torture would be and how much he thinks that that's just a good tool to use, even though it's illegal. And then at a snap of a finger, it's because he talked to someone whose nickname is Mad Dog, which he really likes, and that person said to him that he doesn't think that waterboarding is a good idea and he can do more with, a six-pack and a and cigarettes, that now Donald Trump thinks that maybe waterboarding isn't that good. I mean, that's just the nature of how things can flip back and forth so easily, because there really isn't a grounding in anything other than what Donald Trump seems to think plays well at the moment and what he wants to say at the moment. I mean, I think with Donald Trump, the one grounding that there is that he is creating this oil and gas-filled cabinet, a cabinet full of generals, a cabinet full of, you know, hedge funds and bankers, and he is creating the swamp. I mean, the drain the swamp, of course, was just demagogy. He is creating the ultimate swamp in Washington, D.C., but he does have a program, and it's a program that's a combination of the corporations, the banks, the generals, and the religious right. And he's going to have a frontal attack on labor. He's going to do everything he can to give away what there is in the United States to the corporations and the banks through massive deregulation and vast destruction of the environment. Likely will end employment protections where he can, and he will seek to privatize education and just turn our public education system into a profitable business. He's going to deport millions of immigrants. And he's endorsing a sweeping attack on women's rights and promising to eviscerate fundamental abortion rights and Roe v. Wade. That's the program that we have that we're facing coming into this new year.
Mara, you and the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund have done some really groundbreaking litigation over the past 15 or so years, more actually. What do you see your docket holding over the next couple of years? We expect a real crackdown on First Amendment protected activities. Do you see yourselves changing your work in any fashion?
Well, we've always operated on a sense and a mission of absolute defense of people's fundamental rights to be able to speak out, to express themselves, because we believe that democracy exists well beyond the ballot box, that democracy, in fact, and all progressive change in America is a result of people being able to take to the streets, to be able to speak out, to come together at critical moments. And we would expect, and we are prepared for rapid response situations, that we're going to need to be able to be there, to be out front defending those who themselves are also on the front lines. And that has always been what our work has been. It's what our work will continue to be. I think right now, maybe more than ever, because of the abject failure of the Democratic Party and what is genuinely a liberal elite in America, the fight back against the Trump agenda, the outrageous and dangerous Trump agenda that I was just talking about, is going to come from the people. It's going to have to come from the people. And so many people are outraged by Donald Trump, and I think as more and more people see his giveaways and his failure to protect workers and, to the contrary, his efforts to actually destroy workers' rights in America, there's going to be more and more of a response as people realize that their only voice and hope for change is not coming from their politicians, is not coming from the only other party that's generally offered, which is the Democratic Party. And if that's the case, and as we anticipate that will be the case, as historically it always has been in the case in times of great struggle, we intend to be there to take on what's necessary to ensure that people can be in the parklands, in the streets, that they have the right to speak out, that they can become and are the powerful force that creates change in America.
Speaking of the parks and the public spaces, you have been challenging access for protesters to some of those public lands for the inauguration protests, and I assume tens of thousands are expected to converge in D.C. for that. How is that going? Do you think protesters will be able to exercise their rights fully?
People are going to come to Washington, D.C. at the inauguration no matter what. There are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people who are planning to come to the nation's capital people are going to be coming to the inaugural route on January 20th, coming to demonstrate on the parklands and the sidewalks, abutting the inaugural parade as the administration passes by on inauguration day, to say from the very first moment that they are going to stand up in defense of fundamental rights in the United States and against racism, against misogyny. And the fight that we're having is over the ability for people to have spaces for mass assembly in the parklands abutting the parade route. The National Park Service has set aside wide swaths of these lands, and in particular key locations like Freedom Plaza, which is the main location for assembly alongside Pennsylvania Avenue, as well as, for example, the sidewalks in front of the Trump Hotel, which is now on Pennsylvania Avenue and obviously has political significance. All of these they've taken out of commission and set them aside for Trump's presidential inaugural committee. And this is a matter that we're litigating right now in federal court. We're up at the D.C. Circuit waiting a ruling on these issues. But now there's further manifestation of the unconstitutional conduct of the Park Service in that so many people are also planning to stay from the 20th into the 21st, which is a Saturday and Trump's first day in office. And people want to be able to protest at the White House, which is understandable, in near the White House, in proximity to the White House. And again, the Park Service has taken all of the public federal public lands, the key and iconic locations for mass assembly, and given them over to Trump's presidential inaugural committee, which is being allowed to just hold those spaces and, in effect, is delegating to a private political Trump fundraising platform the ability to decide if, where, whether, when demonstrators will be able to protest against Trump. We just see this as an absolute abridgment of people's right to organize and right to protest.
But it's extraordinarily worrisome that Trump and this cast of characters he's put together. It's also true that at times of great danger, historically, there's always been times of opportunity. And I read a story this morning about the workers in the Environmental Protection Agency, you know, the new head of it, Pruitt. They've issued a questionnaire asking these people whether they've ever been to a climate change conference and do they know anybody else in the agency that's been to one, you know, to create a blacklist and purge them. And I read this morning that these people are refusing to sign the questionnaire. You know, there's silver linings also.
I think that is certainly true. I mean, when you look at what people in the United States have overcome at critical points, they overcame them because they stood up and refused to go along and more specifically fought back against repression. And that's the single way that change has always happened in our society. I mean, if you think about Jim Crow apartheid in the South, and how entrenched and institutionalized that was, I mean, it must have felt like it would be impossible to overcome. And yet, because the nature of humanity and all people is to fight for their freedom and to fight for liberation, people fought back steadily in opposition. It didn't change because of politicians. It didn't change because the political class decided, oh, we're going to give people their rights. It changed because people demanded their rights. And I think people in the United States and also generationally young people in the United States, they're not going to be pushed back to another era. I mean, Trump is taking everyone back to basically a pre-1930s era of completely unrestrained capitalism. And I think there's so many people, and we can see it, and we can feel it, who are willing to stand up, who are willing to fight. There were so many people who had great hope in the election season because they saw Bernie Sanders making you know, reference to fundamental rights that they've always been told by politicians that they weren't even entitled to. And yet now people can see, well, why can't we have that kind of society? Why can't we have that? Now, granted, Bernie Sanders immediately turned and folded into the Democratic Party, but there are all of those supporters around the country who aren't going to step back inside and aren't going to take what's coming.
Mara, we've talked exclusively about domestic matters today, and we can get into foreign relations, but if you would just give a final comment on how you think the rest of the world is viewing this new administration and what that means for really the reputation of a country that I think in many countries was already looked on as an imperialist bully in some ways.
I think that there's a lot of mixed views from different countries around the world because they are concerned about the instability of Donald Trump and what signals he's sending out. But at the exact same time, I think internationally, which is very distinct from what we're seeing as a domestic program, there are an awful lot of countries who are deeply concerned about a Clinton presidency, deeply concerned and justifiably so, as Clinton was a warmonger and a hawk, and, you know, led the bombing and evisceration of Libya, was leaning towards and pushing for the same thing in Syria, was willing to just go right up to the borders of Russia, and people were worried that there would be a World War III under Clinton. So there's a lot of people who felt that Trump's statements over and over again that he would seek to make peace with countries or certainly wasn't going to get into a needless attack on other countries in a military way was, a welcome opening. So I think internationally there's a lot of, I think most countries obviously are taking a wait and see and they're evaluating what's going on and what comes out of his administration. But here too, you can see the Democratic Party's response to Trump right now is again, and the liberal response to Trump right now is not turning back and again fighting for the social issues that matter to people here. Instead, they're saying to the people of the United States that Russia hacked the elections and that Russia is interfering with the United States. And, you know, even that is sort of laughable on its face. I mean, if Russia hacked the elections, how is it then that Clinton got nearly 3 million more votes than Donald Trump? It's not logical. And again, this really shows that the failure of the liberal political establishment to be a leader or even be part of the struggle against what's coming with a Trump administration domestically in the United States. They're just trying to create basically a new HUAC in Congress to investigate Russia and to investigate anyone who's ever actually said that they just didn't think that they should be at war with Russia or other countries. I mean, that's really a problem.
We've been talking with attorney Mara Verheyen-Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice. Before we say goodbye, could you give your website to our listeners so they can keep up with what you're doing?
Yes, our website is justiceonline.org. It's justiceonline, all one word, .org. And right now we're urging people to come because we have thousands and thousands of people writing the National Park Service demanding that they release federal lands for accessibility to people who want to exercise their First Amendment rights. And it's where you can get action alerts on the immediate threats and what the responses are going to be.
Well, Mara, I wasn't sure if I was going to come down to D.C., but I think after talking to you, you've convinced me it's an important gesture. So I will see you in January, and we want to thank you, as always, for your really crucial work.
We encourage everyone to come on January 20th. It is safe. It is lawful. You can be here. You can protest. And you must exercise your rights in order to defend them.
Thank you, Mara. We talk to you soon.
Thanks again, Mara.
Thank you.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Michael, over the next few weeks, President Obama has a chance to do the right thing by pardoning several of our notable political prisoners.
Pardon them or commute the sentences. In any case, let them get out. I mean, some of these people, like Leonard Peltier or Oscar Lopez Rivera, have been in prison 30, 40 years, several of them for 10, 12 years in solitary confinement. President Obama has a chance to do the right thing. These are federal prisoners that we're going to talk about. State prisoners like Mumia cannot be pardoned by the president because they were not convicted of a federal crime in
the
federal
court.
The
governor has to do that.
That being said, Obama could pick up the phone to the governor of Pennsylvania and say, look, what do you need here? Tell me what it is, and I'll get it for you. I want Mumia out of prison. I mean, here's the guy who's comparable to Frederick Douglass, and Obama is watching him rot with deteriorating health and not picking up that phone.
Michael, what about Ethel Rosenberg?
Well, her granddaughter, Jen Mirapol, who's now head of the Rosenberg Fund for Children, has been organizing along with her father and her uncle to get Obama to vindicate Ethel Rosenberg. Ethel and her husband Julius were electrocuted in Sing Sing Prison in New York in 1953 after being convicted of being atomic spies and part of a ring that gave the secret of the atomic bomb to the Soviet Union. At that time, the government knew she was not a spy. She left two orphaned boys, ages 6 and 10, and there was no secret, really, to the atomic bomb. It was really a matter of industrial capacity. The famous Rosenberg case was then used to stir up antagonism against Russia and anti-Semitism. A huge body of evidence demonstrates that Ethel Rosenberg was innocent. Donald Trump's mentor, friend and attorney Roy Cohn was one of the prosecutors who ruthlessly attacked Ethel and colluded with the judge to have her executed. So listeners can help by calling the White House. I'm going to give you the phone number, 202-456-1111. That's 202-456-1111. And ask that President Obama vindicate Ethel Rosenberg.
Thanks, Michael. Another case that has gone on far too long is that of Leonard Peltier. We've talked about this a lot on Law and Disorder, and we urge President Obama to grant clemency to Leonard on humanitarian grounds and in the interest of justice. As our listeners know, Peltier was a leader of the American Indian Movement in the 1970s. At a confrontation at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, between the American Indian Movement and the FBI, two agents were killed. The FBI had worked with a corrupt tribal leadership to suppress the American Indian Movement. At his trial, the prosecution in Peltier's case withheld evidence, including potential key ballistic evidence that would have exonerated him. Leonard has served 40 years in prison and is not eligible for a parole hearing until 2024. His son recently died, and Leonard was not allowed to attend the funeral. Understandably, he is in very poor shape. His health continues to deteriorate. Listeners may sign a petition to Obama at the following website, act.amnestyusa.org. And Michael, what about Chelsea Manning?
Well, she's been at Fort Leavenworth Prison now for 6 years, which is a record for whistleblowers. She was convicted of leaking what has become known as the Iraq War Logs to WikiLeaks, which then published them, and they showed the truth about U.S. war crimes in Iraq. Chelsea is a transgendered person whose confinement in an all-male prison at Fort Leavenworth has been unusually harsh. This included 11 months of solitary confinement. She has twice attempted suicide. Her sentence is 35 years, the longest ever given to a whistleblower. She's already served more time in prison than any individual in U.S. history who has disclosed information in the public interest. So Google Chelsea Manning and please protest and demand her release.
As listeners know, Edward Snowden blew the whistle about the USA's illegal, covert, and global mass surveillance system. This awakened the American public, scandalized the U.S. intelligence agencies, and caused them to partially rein in this surveillance for the first time in four decades. It exposed their close partnership with businesses in conducting surveillance as well. None of this would have happened but for Snowden's courageous act, a public service that even former Attorney General Eric Holder has admitted. But Snowden is facing charges under the Espionage Act, an antiquated World War I law that put another great American hero, Eugene Debs, in prison for making a speech in opposition to the war. Snowden should be honored for his actions and not forced into exile in Russia. The entire U.S. establishment is in favor of prosecuting him. President Obama has wrongly stated that he can't do anything to help Snowden until he returns to this country and gone to trial. A petition urging Obama to pardon Snowden can be accessed at pardonsnowden.org.
Puerto Rican political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera has served 30 years in prison, convicted of seditious conspiracy, a thought crime involving no actual act, because of his commitment to independence for Puerto Rico. He was not accused or convicted of causing harm or taking a life. He was sentenced to 70 years and is one of the longest-held political prisoners in the world. Oscar served in Vietnam. He was awarded a Bronze Star. He came home to Chicago, where he became a talented community organizer. He has served 12 years in isolation in a supermax prison. He comes up for parole when he will be 83 years old. A petition asking President Obama to commute Oscar's sentence can be found at BoracuaHumanRights.org. That's one word, BoracuaHumanRights.org. Please check it out, sign it, and help out Oscar.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.